So the work I'm going to be talking about today appeared in these three papers this year. The first two of which were done in collaboration with Jason Alisea and Dave Asen. My office mate, a graduate student at Caltech, in collaboration with several people from actually the Copenhagen group, in the groups of Charlie Marcus, an experimentalist, and Karsten Flensburg, a theorist. And then the second half of the talk, I'll be talking about this work. And this was done in collaboration with Jason and a very talented undergraduate at Caltech that Jason and I were mentoring for a summer project. And then at some point, I talked to Bella Bauer, and it turns out he was basically doing nearly the same thing we were. And so we joined forces with him and his graduate student, Braden Ware, and Meng Chang. And so kind of my talk is kind of split into two parts. They both contain Majorana modes in condensed matter in a very kind of central way. The first part of the talk is very kind of practical, experimentally relevant, where we kind of describe our efforts towards making Majorana zero modes useful for an eventual quantum computer, kind of doing things that are can be done in the short term, but which can lead to this pipe dream of eventually building a quantum computer out of these kind of devices. And so then in the second part of the talk, it's something that's much less experimentally relevant, much more abstract, so more or less interesting depending on who you ask, where we realize an exotic fermionic topological phase in a class of models which we termed Majorana dimer models. So I'm going to start the first half here, and I'm going to kind of take you through a, 15-year story here from when Kataev first wrote down a toy model for a 1D P-wave superconducting wire up to the present day kind of state-of-the-art experimental situation in this area. Many of you might know this story. If you don't, it's quite nice. And one thing I think that it really does, it really kind of points at how important toy models can be in this field. So here's the Kataev's model. It doesn't get much simpler than this. It's just a 1D fermionic chain where these with open boundary conditions, say, where you have on-site chemical potential at mu, they can hop with strength T, and you have P wave nearest neighbor pairing of strength delta. And a very useful thing to do in this case, and you could do this in any case actually, but it's especially useful here, is you could rewrite the fermion operator in terms of Majoranas. These kind of real operators which obey the famous Majorana statistics or Majorana relations, gamma equals gamma dagger and gamma squares to one. In this case, you kind of do that. There are two prototypical points in this phase diagram which really elucidate the physics. One is the trivial phase of this model. So that's if you turn off T and delta altogether and you just have mu there. So you just have a bunch of fermions on site. Of course, you're just going to either empty out or fill up those modes depending on the sign of mu. But in terms of these Majoranas, they just pair kind of on site. When you rewrite this Hamiltonian, you just get pairing I gamma gamma on a given site. And so you just have this trivial phase, short-range entangled phase, it's just as simple as it gets. But if you just go to the point in the middle of the topological phase at mu equals zero and t equals delta, and you rewrite this, you'll see that the Majoranas pair between sites only. And so you're left with these Majorana modes at the end of the chain, which they don't even appear in the Hamiltonian. So they commute with the Hamiltonian, call them Majorana zero modes. So quite interesting about these guys is that you could then form a fermion which extends across the entire chain. This is over some macroscopic length scale. You could define a fermion as gamma, say this guy, plus I gamma that guy, and it is a very non-local fermion encoding this quantum information. And so the state of this chain then is encoded in whether or not there's an exact twofold degenerate ground state depending on whether or not you occupy this fermion or not. And so the state of this chain is encoded on the fermionic parity of this wire, and so it can't be disturbed or read out locally. And that's a very key concept in this kind of study. And so then That was in 2001. And then kind of, I don't know, 9 years later, inspired largely by developments in looking at edges of 2D topological insulators, these two groups said, okay, we could engineer Kataev's wire using stuff that's already available in the lab. If you just have a 1D quantum wire with spin orbit coupling, these things are quite common. Indium arsenide and indium antimonide are two examples. You apply an external magnetic field. Experimentalists have the ability to do that, certainly. And you need to be able to couple this wire, proximity couple it to an, all you need is an S-wave superconductor. So the intuition here is as follows. I mean, if you want to, what we want is a 1D, a one-band spinless P-wave superconductor. So one thing you can think of doing is just turning on a Zeeman field, and you spin split the two bands. But then, how are you going to pair them on the opposite sides of the Fermi surface? Because they have the same spin. You can't add an S-wave superconductor; it's not going to do anything. And so what you, that's where spin orbit coupling comes in. So you, if you have spin orbit coupling, you have these two spin orbit coupled bands, so that it's really like a it's really a k-dependent Zeeman field. So on the right side here, they might have they might point in the y direction in spin space, and on the left side they point in the minus y direction. So then you when you turn on the magnetic field, it opens up a gap in the middle here, and also cancels those spins. And so then at least those spins have some kind of they're not parallel anymore. So then you can actually do something with the S-wave superconductor, and in fact you can drive it into a P-wave wire basically. And as long as the magnetic field is greater than the square root of delta squared plus mu squared, you're indeed in the same topological phase as I described very in this very simple picture with the toy model. And so then just 2 years later, the first experiments came out which explored this idea. This is a famous experiment by Leo Kruenhoven's group where they did tunneling. They built this wire. So here's the indium, is indium antimonide in this case. There's some lead here. This is a niobium-based superconductor, and they have a magnetic field in there. And they did tunneling spectroscopy into this wire. And a prediction that you get if you have the Majorana is you get perfect Andreev reflection at zero energy. And that manifests itself as a in theory as a quantized zero bias peak in the conductance of value 2e squared over h. So they didn't see this quantization. That would be a smoking gun, certainly. But what they did find is they kind of said, okay, if we take out any of the ingredients that were necessary to give this physics, this peak goes away. It's essentially what they showed. But so there is definitely evidence for the Majorana modes, but there are many lingering issues in this early data, certainly. For instance, the gap. So if this were a nice superconductor, you would have no single particle states below the gap. You'd just get basically a square here, rectangle. But you see this like V shape. So first of all, this is not, certainly you can't build a qubit out of this, because we want these things, you don't want, otherwise the single particle states are just going to be always poisoning our Majorana mode. So this, first of all, would never be useful for anything. This is all we could do. Other issues like there is no evidence for a phase transition. These things, there should be the gap should come and close here and reopen when that Majorana forms, it just kind of pops out of nowhere. These are kind of issues, several other ones that kind of were a little not really matching with the experiment. But there are many groups have been able to at least reproduce this type of data. I mean, Majoranas are kind of appearing everywhere, and everywhere, or zero bias peaks anyway were appearing everywhere in various platforms. This is actually a Josephson experiment. There's also a different platform where you put magnetic atoms on top of a superconducting substrate. The Princeton group did STM. They also kind of had the same kind of tantalizing evidence for the Majorana. But really, there have been significant breakthroughs by the Copenhagen group, specifically over the last couple years. One thing that they were able to really solve is a soft gap problem, at least at small field, before the Majorana is formed. Certainly, there is a very nice hard superconducting gap, so that was a big improvement. And it really involved just making this is like a materials problem. They just needed to. This is actually amazing how they do this, but it's really just a matter of getting that aluminum and that semiconductor interface clean, turned out. And so then they're able to see the exponential degeneracy splitting in one of these wires. This is a very heroic experiment which came out in Nature earlier this year. And so this is really a very strong evidence for Majorana. And the tunneling spectroscopy coming from this group, which is still unpublished, is also beautiful. And you know, it's looking better and better. And so really what this big group of people, including myself, we set out to, you know, it's like we're going beyond now just finding the Majorana mode, but we can now actually start thinking about doing some interesting things with them. We're not gonna build a full quantum computer tomorrow, but we could at least demonstrate the topological physics is operative here. And so the question is, what should we do next with kind of the technology that these guys have now? And so kind of for the first part of my talk, there's really two main goals. The first is to introduce a new scheme, a new kind of platform for realizing Majoranas and doing things with them. And this is an all-electrical approach. And so these guys, Charlie Marcus's group, they're able to make transmon qubits actually without magnetic flux. And they're doing so by basically gating between two superconducting segments. And these are actually, and so they have the ability to do this. And so we said, okay, maybe we can kind of translate that over into a topological qubit. This is called the gatemon qubit, which is really a transmon controlled by electric gating. And so, but we can imagine taking that technology to these topological wires and seeing what we could do. And then within this scheme, we wanted to lay out a series of kind of reasonable experiments that they can do, say, in the next couple years, and really try to pin down that these are perhaps useful, viable devices for quantum computing, hopefully. They might not be the best qubits, the first generation qubits, they might not be the best, but if we could just demonstrate that they have the potential, I think that'll be very important. And so these protocols, they should also be adaptable not only to this kind of all electrical scheme, to other approaches as well. And the experiments are mainly fusion rule detection and qubit validation. These are the two that I really want to focus on in the talk. And so first I'm going to just describe the scheme. Here's an outline. So first I'll describe the scheme, then I'll go through the various experiments. And so, yeah, what we really want to do here is kind of harness the ability that they had, and kind of there's like a whole community of people working on quantum dots and spin qubits. I mean, we kind of want to use those kind of capabilities in this problem. And this is kind of similar to what was done by Carlo Beinacker's group at Leiden using the transmon and using that technology to do topological stuff. We're going to kind of use spin qubits instead. And so here's like a cartoon of the kind of devices that we have in mind. You have this indium arsenide nanowire, and what they could do is they could grow they could put a very clean sheet of aluminum on top. That's this orange thing. So this is the superconductor. And then you have a B field, which you need for Majoranas. And then we also want to have a trivial bulk superconductor nearby. We want this to be a superconductor because we don't want any single particle excitations to possibly poison our Majorana system. So usually you have a normal lead here. We want a superconducting lead. And you also have a gate down here, which controls the density of electrons on the island. And then there's this all-important valve, which controls the coupling between these two superconductors. And so we could model this with some simple phenomenological Hamiltonian, where we just have Josephson coupling plus charging energy on this island. And so if you have this valve closed and you deplete all carriers in this link here, then you're quenching the Josephson energy. You just have a quantum dot on this island. You can then imagine opening up this valve as much as you can and hopefully quench the charging energy. And so it's here that if you have the magnetic field, that this will be the topological superconductor that we're interested in. And so we could get some intuition for what we could do with this. In the case where the valve is completely closed, we could look at the energy spectrum as a function of this side gate voltage, which is proportional to N naught here. And so you just get parabolas. You're just turning this off, you just get parabolas. Quite simple. If you open it up a little bit, then you get avoided crossings between these curves with the same parity. So each one of these curves, so the red is like, say, even parity, and the blue is odd parity. For the number of electrons on the island. And then if you crank up the Josephson energy much larger than the charging energy by opening up the valve, this is like the transmon regime in that field. But now we get two nearly degenerate states which depend on the parity of these two Majoranas. So if that parity is even, then it's one of those states. If the parity is odd, it's another state. And these, what's very important here is that that splitting is exponentially small in some parameter, namely the square root of Ej over Ec. If that was not exponentially small, this would not have any hope of being topological, but it is. And so what we've kind of done here is we could take a given charge state, say this red or these blue, and do this and evolve it into a known parity state of those two Majoranas, if you do it adiabatically. Or you could also then use this ability to read out this pair of Majoranas by closing the valve. And then so the experimentalists, these quantum dot people, they know how to distinguish charge Q from Q plus one like nobody's business. They've been doing this for forever. And so this is the basics of the scheme. And so of course, just one island is not all that interesting. If you have conserved fermion parity, that topological superconductor is stuck in state zero or one. And so we want to really go beyond one island and go to two islands. And so there are several interesting configurations which are possible here. I mean, now we have two islands, two bulk superconductors, three valves. If all valves are closed, you have two quantum dots with a given charge. If you open up one of the valves and these two islands will couple, you get a single dot, basically. If you just have all valves open, then this is all topological, this is trivial, then you're going to get your two Majoranas at the far ends of these two islands. Or if you close the middle valve, then you can nucleate two more Majoranas now at the center of the of this device. So this actually forms a prototype topological qubit, which people are calling this the ASIN qubit for my office mate now, because he's the first author on the paper. So this is and we're going to use this qubit to demonstrate fusion rules and qubit and topological qubit validation. More islands, you could do braiding if you have three and T junction, which I'll talk about briefly. Maybe you could scale this up. I don't know. But we just want to focus on these kind of short-term issues. And so first I'm going to talk about fusion rules. And so this is, a very fundamental topic, which is kind of, at least in this context, not been discussed so much. There have been several papers, there are a few papers here which do discuss it, but it's maybe a total of like one page in the literature on fusion rules in this in the context of Majoranas, experimentally anyway, detecting them. And so, of course, when people talk about such systems, they focus on the non-abelian statistics, which is rightfully so. I mean, you get this like fault-tolerant qubit rotations by, simply braiding these anions around one another. And so if you say you have four Ising anions, which make binding Majorana zero modes, at fixed parity, you'll get two degenerate ground states. And then if you braid them, you'll get a qubit rotation based on the braid matrix. But you could also consider what happens when you fuse them. So that's what, so you start off with these two locally indistinguishable ground states, you bring them together. So in the case of Ising anions, which are relevant to Majoranas, they could either be fused into the vacuum or they could create a fermionic quasiparticle. And so these are actually, these are related. This is really just the zero state of that fermion when the zero state of that fermion, that Dirac fermion that you form when you combine the Majoranas, whereas this is the one state of that fermion. And so actually, this kind of physics implies non-abelian statistics. And so if you can identify this physics in a simpler experiment than you can this physics, then you'll be sure that this will eventually be there, although maybe you can't demonstrate it directly. And so there's actually like some rigorous proofs of this arrow here, appeared recently.
So is this one of the right anyon models for universal quantum computing?
So no, well, you can't you can't get universal quantum computing by braiding with these. That's an issue. But you can get some of the operations protected with braiding, and so that's useful. To you're not going to need as many qubits eventually. I mean, that's is that. But you know, it's all we have. I mean, you know, there are such anyons which can, but we can't do anything with them yet, so we don't have them in the lab. But so what we want to do is verify this fusion rule. I'm going to take you through the how we do that. So we start off with this configuration where the middle valve is open, the two guys on the end are closed, and I'm first going to go through a control experiment, which is not going to be so interesting, but it's useful as a control. And then we're going to first close the middle valve. You get then you just get two quantum dots with charged state QL and QR. If you open up the outer valves, you nucleate two pairs of Majoranas, which are fused accordingly, according to these dashed lines. So you pull those out of the vacuum. You say you put them in the zero state for each one of those pairs. And then if you close the outer valves, what that's going to do is that's going to split those two states. And this is really where we're doing fusion. They're split basically by the charging energy now. But all we're doing is we've just gone back to where we started. And so the parities haven't the parity of this guy is just given by where we started here. So you basically just get deterministic readout. And effectively what we're doing here is we're only accessing one of the fusion channels when we brought these two guys together. And so if you were to do this experiment, you'd always get the same result. And so, but if you do something just slightly different, you just switch the order of these two operations. If you first open the outer valves, that nucleates Majoranas on the ends, and then close the middle valve before we did it in the opposite order, then you pull these two, then you nucleate a second pair of Majoranas. And so then this state is just the zero. It's like 0, 1, 4, 0, 2, 3. And then when you write that, then we're going to fuse. And when you write that in the measurement basis, which is this like left-right basis, very simple result, you get an equal amplitude superposition of those two states. And so this is really, so now we're fusing into the identity channel and the fermionic channel with equal probability. And so if we could see this, there's lots of universal content in the fact that this is an equal amplitude superposition. And so in principle, this is demonstrating the fusion rule. And so it's quite simple. I mean, for one, they only need one wire. That's what's really important here. That's all they can do right now, at least at this level of quality. And so there's another experiment where they don't have to just read out the charge. They can just do it. We call it a charge pump. So these kind of people like to do these things a lot, where you just do so basically you do the same thing that we just did, but rather than reading out the charge, we do some manipulations of the valve so that when only the psi channel appears, you actually pump a Cooper pair through the wire. And so that you'll get a current going through this device, which is so that psi channel only, if this is Majoranas, the psi channel only appears half the time. And every time you get a 2e Cooper pair, so times the frequency, you get a current quantized at e times the frequency that you drive this. And the control cycle, on the other hand, never accesses the psi channel. It doesn't pump anything. And so this is maybe a easier experiment. They don't need the charge sensing in there. So a few important remarks. I mean, you should do as many controls as possible. Obviously, just getting a random answer half the time it's even, half the time it's odd, is probably not going to be that convincing. So the control experiment should work to exclude noise as a source of error, as a source of the probabilistic readout, I mean. And like I mentioned before, the order of manipulations that we did, all we did was did the same thing in different orders. And getting different outcomes is only possible because of some ground state degeneracy. So at the very least, or at least, you know, convincing ourselves that we have ground state degeneracy. Hopefully it's topological. And there are many practical issues that we had to think very carefully about. As far as, you need to be slow enough to avoid corrupting the system from excited states. So you have to definitely be slower than the gap, superconducting gap, for instance. You have to be slower than the charging energy. Otherwise, what I said is just not going to work. You also need to be fast enough to, so there's some residual splitting between the Majoranas. You need to actually be fast enough that you are ignorant of that. Otherwise, you'll always get stuck in one of those two states, which are only slightly degenerate. And you also need to be fast enough so that quasi-particles don't jump onto your your Majorana device. And so some of these issues, especially this one, was worked out in some detail by some of our collaborators. And so really, I think a thorough experiment should actually violate these speed limits. And then you could actually see when our results come in and out of fashion. You could actually glean information about various device parameters, for instance, the gaps and the splitting. And so a thorough experiment is actually going to explore all regimes of this, all kind of protocol rates for this kind of experiment. And so that concludes the fusion rule part. If there's any questions? So now I'm going to get on to qubit validation. I think this is actually my favorite part of this paper. So what we're trying to do here is, okay, this qubit is a prototype topological qubit. So the two states of the qubit, so if you have fixed fermion parity, which is say even, then the two qubit states are just the two Majoranas either being in the even-even or odd-odd state. And then you have these two locally distinguishable ground states. And I want to assume from now on that we're working on time scales much less than the quasi-particle poisoning time. Really what I mean by that is that we're assuming that the poisoning time is infinite. And we just want to make some universal statements about what this topological qubit is based on these assumptions. We also want to assume that the system is always confined to this ground state manifold so that the temperature is less than this gap. There aren't any other any other subgap states here, and that we're not, the noise isn't of sufficiently high frequency to drive us up in other states, et cetera. And so we really want to focus on this regime and say something as universal as we can. And in particular, I'd like to distinguish this qubit from another qubit where you might just have some ordinary fermionic states near the edge of these wires, say, called Andrea-bound states, which also can have, maybe they're just accidentally degenerate. Can we distinguish these two qubits? On the surface, they look quite similar.
Is the fusion rule?
It does. To get the fusion rule, if that were to work, this would have to be highly fine. This would have to be even more fine-tuned beyond just being degenerate. If that were to work, then yeah. But that's a little more. This is a little more direct, I would say, what I'm going to talk about now. And so really, what we're going to do is we're going to focus on this residual splitting, which is exponentially small, either in L over C. And so this is if the Majorana overlap is dominating the splitting. This is if the residual charging energy is dominating it. And then we're going to assume that there's some low frequency noise which alters omega naught instantaneously through these parameters. So like the magnetic field and the chemical potential, these can be fluctuating in time. And really what we're going to do is, can we validate the topological nature by examining both the splitting and its coherence time, specifically T2? We know that they should have long coherence times, but exactly what do we, what is, how can we be, really nail it down? And what about experimental protocols to measure the coherence times as well? So first of all, I'll just mention the protocol that we have to actually measure both omega naught and T2 within our scheme. And so it's like a spin echo or Ramsey experiment. So we know how to initialize a qubit into the zero state, say that's at the bottom of the Bloch sphere. Then we have to apply, if we apply a pi over 2 pulse, we can do that in this basis by modulating this interval, which couples these inner Majoranas. So this is really a sigma x coupling on the and for this qubit. So this is not topologically protected. But so if their experiments are going to do this, they're going to have to fine-tune the heck out of this. But it's only one qubit. And so they should, they seem to say we should be able to do that. And so assuming they could do a pi over 2 pulse, then we're going to let it evolve for a certain amount of time t. This is where there's going to be some dephasing in general as it goes around the equator. Then we're going to actually apply another pi over 2 pulse and then read out the system. And we're interested in the probability that the qubit has flipped in this process. Then, so if you do that and you assume that this noise, say the noise and the chemical potential or the magnetic field are changing the splitting with a given kind of amplitude delta EZ tip, and you assume that noise is 1 over F for simplicity, and it seems to be what people like to use, and you get something looks like this. You get a cosine with a decaying exponential. And so first of all, the period of this cosine actually gives you the splitting itself, which is actually a useful way, I think, to find the splitting. And it also gives the dephasing time t2. And so this at least provides a recipe. Now this will happen for any qubit, in fact. But this provides a recipe for measuring this qubit's omega naught and t2. But we really want to go beyond that and validate that it's topological. And so the key point here is that no matter what local noise source you throw at this system, they all hit the instantaneous splitting through here. They all contain an exponential. And so, and really, all this 1 over the t2 time is really just detecting the amplitude in the fluctuation of the splitting. And if it all contains an exponential, therefore it will be exponentially suppressed. And so you could kind of see this. So let's say we could imagine probing this by setting the Zeeman field somewhere and looking at the splitting. So we might measure some splitting. We should then find some t2 time. Here, if we then decrease the magnetic field, go deeper into the topological phase, the splitting will then also be exponentially small. And so there's really a locking between the splitting, the t2 time, and they're both exponential. So all parts of this kind of, we call this a scaling relation, which could be used as a definition for a topological qubit, which I think people had not really appreciated before, and it could maybe in hindsight it's kind of obvious, but it's very non-trivial, and it also really demonstrates why this is a useful qubit. You can make the dephasing time exponentially long by just changing a parameter. I mean, this is really why, one of the reasons why this is an exciting field, actually. And so for the trivial qubit, where even if they're accidentally degenerate, you could have kind of the magnetic field, which are going to be altering those states, they are not going to have anything to do with an exponential. And so you will lose that exponential part of the scaling relation, for instance. So you could definitely rule that out. And also, I mean, since this is kind of probing the derivative of omega naught, you should get actually out of phase relations if they're Majorana overlap dominated. Splittings. So this is kind of probing detailed aspects of the Majorana theory. I don't want to talk too much about this, but if you kind of use the same assumptions and do some simple calculation, the T1 time, this is actually very misleading. So the T1 time depends linearly on omega naught here. But this actually looks very bad. Looks like it's, but this is a calculation assumes that omega naught is much, much greater than this kind of coupling, the noise and the coupling in the middle gate. But this also then, they depend on omega naught, and they both depend on omega naught in a non-trivial way. So this will also is also an extra kind of scaling relation involving T1. It's possible that the poisoning time is just going to, this is not maybe relevant. Maybe the poisoning time is much less than whatever you're finding here, but it's something to keep in mind. So I'm going to very briefly talk about braiding, which has been, it's been discussed by many people over the last 5 years. So we just want to, I just want to describe how we have a way to implement it in this kind of scheme, in this ASIN qubit scheme, where we, now we just have it, we have a T-junction. So this is what is difficult to build experimentally, but it's easy to draw cartoons with. Then you, through some valve manipulations, you basically open up this middle valve, you could pull this Majorana down here, and then you shuttle the middle guy across by changing these middle valves, and then you can move this guy back up here. And so we've exchanged these inner two Majoranas, and this is should be a, you know, a fault tolerant, you know, exponentially good qubit rotation of pi over 2 about the x-axis. And so they should read out, so then if they do this, they should read out again half the time even parity, half the time odd parity. And of course, what's very important here is actually this phase, and we're not accessing that phase and just reading out the charge states. And so a better experiment is actually to do this and actually do a double braid. So so what this is telling us is that if we get half, half and half, then we're rotating about some axis very well. If we rotate twice, then we should rotate about the same axis. If we do it again, then it flips the qubit with 100% probability. And so then this is really kind of the smoking gun, I think, to show that you're seeing braiding. And so this would really show the rigidity of this topological qubit. I mean, this is what people have been thinking about doing for a long time. We just want to show that it can be done in our qubit. I mean, and so, yeah.
Is this that phase factor some universal property of the system?
Yeah. It's
relative phase. It's two small some phase between the two.
Well, there's e to the I. There's an I with that is important. That's showing that you're rotating by pi over 2 about the x-axis, and you're landing on the y-axis. I mean, there's some maybe overall phase, but then there's, in our scheme, there's not, we can't identify that I, because you're just reading out probabilities. But doing it twice at least shows that you're rotating about the same axis, and you're flipping the qubit with 100% probability. This is a kind of, I want to also just talk about this briefly. We also then kind of re-examined the kind of tunneling spectroscopy issue and wanted to see what we could say about this lack of a topological phase transition in these experiments. And we came upon some interesting things. For one, so this is, I mean, I don't really have time to talk about this, but this is the magnetic field, and this is the energy. So this is really the what you would get if you were doing these original kind of experiments that Kuenhoven was doing, and we're plotting the density of states of the wire out of the page here. And so typically what you find is if you crank up the magnetic field and you're in the topological phase, you get these zero modes, these zero bias peaks appearing. Kind of the thing that we wanted to point out was that actually it's possible that in the devices that they have, the bulk gap of this system, which should, if it's a real good phase transition, the bulk gap should close and reopen when these Majoranas appear. Of course, they didn't see that. That could be for several reasons, but one of them could have just been that the system was too small to see that. Normally, you would think that if the system is too small to see that and the phase transition is bad, there's no way you could get Majoranas. But it's not the case. You could actually get fairly decent Majoranas even with a terrible phase transition where the bulk gap barely even closes at all. And this is actually due to if you have sufficiently strong spin-orbit coupling and not unreasonably strong spin-orbit coupling. And so you could easily get Majoranas even without a good phase transition, just a very strong crossover. So this was kind of actually interesting to us. And it also then allows you, if you can do this and you can identify these states, you can actually extract what the spin orbit coupling is at the phase transition. And this is actually inspired by this data, this still unpublished data from Charlie's group by these guys, where we're looking at this data and we saw we can maybe even see this first excited state in this wire. And maybe this is like a reasonable explanation. I'm not sure, I don't want to push this interpretation onto their data, but it's a reasonable explanation. And in that case, I mean, that would be a fairly nice explanation for what they're seeing. But okay, so that concludes the first part of the talk. And so I'm gonna, if there are any questions on that, I'll move on to the second part.
Just a general question. Like, if you compare this to this service code model, topological quantum computing, that's gonna be, is there advantages and disadvantages of experimentally?
Well, so, certainly. So I think to do these kinds of operations, for instance, there's like, this pi over two rotation, they need the whole surface code to do that well. Or we could do that with one device, right? I mean, you just need much less. And then more generally, I mean, you can't get a fully protected gate set with these, but you're gonna need less qubits eventually. If you can
get a fully protected gate set with their model, right?
Uh-huh. So, but they, well, you know, I mean, you need to, yeah. But, I mean, there will be error correction necessary, even with these. It's just less qubits, I think, is when it comes down to it.
Is it not how that error correction works? Because there's like a stabilizer model for the uniform stabilizers and the surface code. Like, how does the error correction work for these types of qubits?
Well, yeah, I mean, you would have to build. You know, I'm not sure. I mean, what you're saying, if you had a,
like, service code.
I mean, Kataev and Brevik, they have a whole scheme for. I mean, you need a. What do you? I don't know.
Well, like, in my service code, you know how to apply stabilizers to see the errors. You know where the errors are. You know the syndrome, and then there's a minimally perfect matching.
Yeah, I'm not a service code guy, so I don't know. I'm not a service code jock, so maybe somebody else say.
There must be some analogy.
Suppose the two dots are not identical. In reality, in experiments, we prefer to have indistinguishable dots. And how much?
Oh, that shouldn't matter.
Matter.
No, definitely not. Otherwise,
why?
Because I mean the so you're saying if the dots were different, then you would have. That would have different. They would still be exponentially small. But I mean, the quantity, the splitting, for instance, would still be exponentially small as long as unless one of the dots was like well out of the exponent, well was way too short or something, then I mean, there might be some that difference actually that would be. I think those kind of differences would be relevant if you had an Andreev qubit or something. But in this case, if you're just
Also, is there a true finite temperature phase transition out of the topological phase in this case? Unlike they say the core code where there is zero temperature, even though there's a gap.
Is there a finite temperature phase transition? No, I guess. No.
What about finite temperature effects? Are all these effects topological effects protected by the gap?
At finite temperature, I mean, you have to be much less than, as long as the temperature is much less than the gap, then you're good. But as soon as you go above the gap, then it's garbage.
Yeah, comparing, for example, the Torr code where there is a finite gap, but it's a zero temperature phase transition. So you have to, at finite temperature, you rely on the crossover. There's no actual protection at any finite temperature.
There's no exponent.
You can rely on finite size effects, but there's no zero temperature transition. So in a large system, the temperature scale is below a gigabit, the protection is vanishing. Even though the gap rate is finite. So I don't know how, I'm just curious if that's relevant in this case.
No, I think it's
true finite temperature phase.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think it's the same, but I don't know.
I'm wondering, because in the experiment, it's possible you could see some features that are robust at finite finite temperature, but if it,
I mean, it,
there weren't,
it's a finite size system anyway, but
right.
So, yeah. So I'm gonna now kind of move on to much more kind of theory heavy stuff, where, so here the motivation here actually started with thinking about the resonating valence bond state, which some of the people in here know quite a lot about. And this is, of course, due to Anderson, who introduced it in the context of the triangular lattice Heisenberg model in 1973, and then kind of reintroduced it 15 years later in the context of the cuprates. And the state is an equal amplitude superposition of all dimer coverings on some lattice, where the dimer coverings here refer to singlet pairings between the between the spin halves on the vertices of this lattice. And I mean, kind of initially it was just thought to be an interesting disordered ground state of the anti-ferromagnet, and then Anderson and many others, they started thinking about what happens when you dope the system. It's a very, and that becomes a very kind of good playground to search for high temperature superconductors, because the energy scales for killing the eventual superconductor then given by the energy scales of these kind of dimers, which are like Heisenberg energies, exchange energies. And so what I want to focus on here is, for the purposes of this talk, is the spin-on excitations. Of such a state. So you can imagine breaking one of these dimers into, say, a triplet, and then you can, in this kind of resonating valence bond soup, you can then move these spins. If the Hamiltonian is supporting this phase, then you can basically, beyond some short distance scale, you can move these spins far apart with no energy cost. So we say they're deconfined. You know, gaps, deconfined excitations, gap because it takes some finite energy to break that bond. And so what we want to do is somehow create an RVB out of Majorana's. And so imagine a lattice of Majorana modes in two dimensions, and replacing that spin degree of freedom with the Majorana operator, gamma. And so what does the oval mean now? Before it meant singlet. Now it means we're gonna fuse those two Majoranas into a common fusion channel. So say the identity channel. And to do that, the bonds need to be oriented so that you can consistently define a fermion. So there's some orientation of this graph. If you traverse from I to J and the arrow is kind of in your favor, then you say that this variable is plus one. If not, it's minus one. So this is just a convention. And then what we want to do is we want to take an equal amplitude superposition of putting all of these kind of dimer coverings into the zero state and summing them up. And so really kind of the initial motivation that we had for this was as follows. What happens if now you're able to, you know, break one of these bonds? Then if it were in this kind of soup still, then you could imagine these guys floating far apart with no energy cost. Now, the thing is, these are Majoranas. So these are basically Ising anions. And so we should be able to, this should be some sort of Ising type topological phase, non-abelian Ising type topological phase that we should be able to understand in this picture. And so spent a lot of time thinking about how to formulate this. We eventually went to a Hilbert space where we not only have Majoranas on the vertices, but we have dimers on the edges of the lattice. And so at the there's some sigma z sub e, which is either plus or minus one, depending on whether or not there's a dimer. And then you have Majorana fermions on the vertices. And we want to generally work in a situation where these Majoranas are paired according to this kind of rule that I described earlier. In order to really make progress on this system, we need to make these bosonic dimers orthogonal. This is kind of similar to originally we could want to describe, if it was only Majoranas, that's kind of analogous to trying to find the spin RVB in a spin half system. That's a much harder problem than finding such a thing in a dimer model. And so that's kind of our approach here. And so there's some basics here. It's somewhat non-trivial, actually, to guarantee that the superposition is an eigenstate of fermion parity. We can do that, though, if we have this graph oriented appropriately according to something called a Castellan orientation, which is means that every kind of, if you go around any four-site plaquette here, say you always get an odd number of arrows pointing clockwise. And so if you have such a state, we can show that at least on a planar graph, you can guarantee that the parity is conserved. And we can understand that fairly easily. If you just say you take another dimer covering here, you do the transition graph, you'll get loops. And these loops actually, if you consider these reference dimers, these blue guys as sites of the lattice, then these loops are actually the topological phase of the Kataev chain, which I described like on the first slide of the talk. So you can then imagine maybe cutting these loops, and then you could also, that's another way to see that you might have kind of deconfined non-abelian excitations. And so anyway, the parity of this, you can always show if you have this kind of orientation, the parity of this is always going to be even. Say if the reference dimer configuration is even, all loops are going to have even parity. So on a planar graph, this is a very well-defined state. So on closed manifolds, things are a little more tricky. But it depends only on the topological. So for fixed boundary conditions, so then you could imagine extending this Castellan orientation in a natural way, where you just extend these arrows and wrap them around. So we call that periodic boundary conditions. So the parity of these configurations only depend on the boundary conditions and on the winding number sector. So for instance, like this configuration here, which would be in the 0-1 sector, you could convince yourself that that has odd fermion parity. So actually, if you have periodic boundary conditions, all the non-trivial topological sectors actually have odd fermion parity, whereas the trivial, the 0-0 sector has even parity. Then you could imagine changing the boundary conditions of the fermions by flipping these arrows. For instance, if you flip the arrows along this direction, all that does is it'll actually like flip the parity. So if you then take anti-periodic boundary condition in the x direction, you flip the parity back to 1. So you can make this table. And so our goal here is to find this kind of Majorana RVB state as an equal amplitude superposition of all dimer coverings with the Majoranas paired appropriately. And so here's kind of a way to write it. They have all dimer coverings. For a given dimer covering, the fermionic part of the Hilbert space is just the ground state of this non-interacting fermionic Hamiltonian, where everything is kind of paired up according to this Castellan orientation. And so here's what the Hamiltonian looks like. So these are constraint terms, which are just pushing us into the dimer sector where we only have one dimer emanating from every site. And this guy is basically enforcing the fact that the Majoranas are paired appropriately. So we're really going to end up cranking up these terms to infinity. And then the rest of the model looks exactly very similar to the quantum dimer model in the triangular lattice, with the exception of when you do these kind of dimer flips, you have to be very careful about what happens to the fermionic sector. And in fact, all you need to do is braid these Majoranas within these triangles. And so these U matrices are actually the same matrices that the same pi over 2 rotations that I talked about in the first part of the talk. And also, we can in general have a defined models with the phase here. We actually need to select this phase in order to do things, in order for things to carry through. So this is the kinetic energy part of the dimer model, and this is the usual potential term, which looks just like it would in the quantum dimer models. And so in order to attack this problem, first of all, what we're going to do is we're going to crank up these constraint terms and work in the Dimer-Hilbert space. And then what we did is we said, okay, let's look at the matrix elements of the full Hamiltonian in this Hilbert space. So the diagonal terms look just like they would in the bosonic quantum dimer model. You just get V times the number of flippable plaquettes between two dimer configurations, D and D prime. If they're the same configuration. If the configurations differ by only flipping one plaquette, then you're going to get a minus T. That's what you would get in the bosonic case. But because of the fermions, you're going to get a non-trivial phase. And if we can eliminate this phase by just changing the, by just doing some transformation on the fermionic part of the Hilbert space. Remember, these are just defined as vacuums of a bunch of fermions, so we don't care about the overall phase so much in defining this. That can we go about doing this sort of transformation to eliminate these phases? If we can, then actually this the Hamiltonian maps directly on to the quantum dimer model. And so we, in that case, we say that the system is unfrustrated, and it'll have the same spectrum of the bosonic quantum dimer model. Then we could buttress off of, like, you know, 2 decades worth of work on that and make some statements. And in fact, on a system with open boundary conditions, like on a disk or like the clusters that I showed earlier, we can analytically prove that, and it's somewhat non-trivial proof, that indeed we can always get rid of those phases. And so we can always basically then map and import all the results from the quantum dimer model, in particular from the famous results from Mosner and Sondi in 2001, who showed that this RVB phase is an extended phase in the bosonic quantum dimer model on the triangular lattice. So it was like the first realization of a spin liquid in a microscopic model, arguably. And so kind of then for a system with open boundary conditions at the RK point, which is the Rockshore-Kivelson point at V equals T, then by construction, the Majorana RVB state is actually the exact ground state. Then by continuity, we're gonna have a extended phase with a unique ground state. And it's also what's also quite important for us is that we know that the bosonic Z2 spin liquid has no gapless edge. And so our Majorana state will also not have a gapless edge. And so this is important to reconcile some things that you might be thinking. If we have Ising topological order, how do you not have a gapless edge? Well, I'll get to that shortly. But so we also then, if we could put this system on a torus, and then so we could check, we actually check numerically that only, that you can always get rid of those phases in the Hamiltonian. You could only do so in the 3 non-trivial topological sectors. In the other sector, you can't do that. And so, I mean, this is not, you know, this is not obvious. It needed to be checked numerically for the triangular lattice. We actually have another lattice, which I'll mention at the end, where we could show this more rigorously. We actually have an exactly solvable model. But, and then we did ED on the system. And the RV at the RK point, the these three, actually that should be 1, 0, 0, 1, and 1, 1. Those sectors are the RVB states are exact zero energy states at the RK point. They all have odd fermion parity, as I described earlier. Whereas the states at in the 0, 0, 0 sector is an excited state at the RK point. And then the so-called staggered states, which are also zero energy states at the RK point, they get lifted off into a excited states in the RVB phase. And so if this kind of stuff holds certainly within in the thermodynamic limit, then we'll have an extended threefold degenerate, so-called Majorana RVB phase. And so a natural candidate for this topological order, I'm going to argue, is a bosonic Ising phase times a P minus IP superconductor with the opposite chirality of the Ising phase. And so this guy will have a deconfined, I haven't shown directly that our state has a deconfined non-abelian Ising particle, but heuristically we believe it to be there. This will definitely have that. We know that our state has a fully gapped edge. We basically showed that quite rigorously, if you believe previous work on the quantum dimer, we showed that our state has a gapped edge. And so this state also has a gapped edge because we selected the chirality of this P plus IP superconductor to be opposite what you would get for the Ising phase. And so the two central charges cancel. And so that was important to reconcile what we were seeing. And also for this state, we expect a threefold degenerate ground state on the torus. You get three ground states coming from Ising for fixed boundary conditions. you only get one state for the Peoples IP superconductor, and also it's known that a Peoples IP superconductor in the topological phase has odd fermion parity. This is something that Reed and Green showed in their famous paper. And so that's kind of why our states have odd fermion parity, is coming from this Peoples IP superconductor. And so, you know, this is a, so we also have a different model, which is an exactly solvable commuting projector model, a very similar situation, just the model is more complicated in terms of the Plaquette terms and stuff, because we're on this so-called Fisher lattice here. But everything carries through, and then we're able to show using these minimally entangled states calculations on this model, which has like zero correlation length. We're able to show with just doing numerics on this little, this cluster here, all right, that we can pretty much unambiguously show that it has this kind of topological order. And so that is,
that's a commuting projector Hamiltonian. You can solve it exactly, right?
Yeah. Well,
pretty sure.
What did I say pretty sure on?
Because it's exactly soluble, right? You can just write down, solve the
Hamiltonian. Oh, no, I'm saying, no, I mean, there is some, you have to in order to really nail this down, we're sure. I mean, but this had to be done numerically, though. I mean, it's just a, but that's fine. I mean, this was a little tricky how to, you know, the Meng and Braden, they figured out how to really nail this down, but it's, you can't, you know, I mean, it's, we had to take input from the central charge being zero, for instance, but, I mean, so that actually can conclude. So kind of future work we're working on now, replacing the myrons with parafermions, trying to get something with maybe deconfined parafermion excitations. So very kind of very complicated problem, I'll say. Another thing which we started doing when Jason, June Ho, and I started, we didn't have the dimers in there. We just wanted to realize a state with only myrons. And that's a harder problem. I mean, certainly to find a Hamiltonian, that's very hard. Even just working with the wave function is very nasty. But I think I want to come back to that as well. And then you could think about physical realizations of this and maybe engineering it in an experiment. I mean, it's some sort of, you have some array of nanowires with myrons and try to interact them somehow. Also, a vortex lattice and a Peoples IP superconductor actually forms a triangular lattice. So that's a fairly reasonable platform if you could engineer the interactions appropriately. I think it's an interesting problem to try to see. Maybe this is a very natural phase which comes out of an interacting system of myrons. I don't know. So that's all. Thank you.
I wonder if you can do this like Pfaffian counting.
Yeah, so
Bilbaugh did to.
So I this? Maybe I in fact Junho, I said once, I said try to find a Pfaffian representation.
Yeah,
he's a very smart guy. He couldn't do it, but I mean I think it's possible. I mean if there's a different representation and you don't have to do we couldn't find a sine free way to do it on a triangular lattice. Using the valence bond basis. I think that's hopeless, but maybe another representation, I think, is possible. That would be nice.
If you think about this as starting with the dimer model addressing it with myrons, so are you just relying on the fact that you have deconfined monomers and it doesn't care about the fact that it's Z2 topological order, for example, or if you took some other abelian topological phase that wasn't Z2, and then dressed it, would you still expect it
but,
the same?
But you, if you still have, if you're saying to what extent is a Z2 important?
Yeah, does it care about the origin of the phase or just the fact if, that it's
just the fact that you have deconfined? That's an interesting question, actually. Because it's kind of the Z2 part doesn't really, at the end of the day, that topological order wasn't so apparent, right?
So you start with the myrons, you probably always end up with the same phase if you put it on the deconfined.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I don't know if there's a, if you have a nice construction. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah. Maybe somebody else could, I mean, another thought of that. I don't know. Yeah.
If there are no further questions, just thank Brian again.